What if I told you the absolute fastest way to lose money in real estate is falling in love with a beautiful oak tree?
Oh man, it sounds crazy, but it is so incredibly true.
Right. I mean, think about it. When you buy a home to live in yourself, the whole conversation just starts with a feeling. You walk through the front door, you see the natural light hitting those, original hardwood floors.
And you look out at that massive oak tree in the backyard.
Exactly. And suddenly your brain just completely floods with emotion. You start picturing your life there, your kids playing in the yard.
But when you buy a property as an investment, that exact same emotion is, well, it's your biggest liability.
You literally have to turn off that part of your brain entirely. You can't care about the tree. You can't care about the paint color at all.
It requires a total paradigm shift. I mean, if you want to survive as an investor, you have to replace that visceral emotional response with a cold, calculated, totally data-driven compass.
You have to look at a property like a mechanic looks at a car engine. It is strictly about the data. It's about what's actually under the hood.
Yeah, exactly. You have to be ruthless about the numbers.
And that is exactly the shift we are going to help you make today. So, welcome to this deep dive. Our mission today is highly, highly focused.
Very focused. We're getting right to the core of it.
We've gathered some really comprehensive research, step-by-step methodology, and core principles on real estate investing. And we are specifically zeroing in on how to calculate return on investment or ROI.
Which is the holy grail of real estate math.
Totally. We are taking all of the source material and decoding it for you. The goal is to distill these concepts so that by the end of this conversation, you can look at any property deal like a seasoned pro, without getting bogged down in all the noise.
And there's a lot of noise out there.
So much noise. Okay, let's unpack this. Real estate is famous for being this like ultimate wealth builder. We all hear the crazy success stories.
Yeah, the people retiring at 30 on passive income.
Right. But the reality is, not every property with a for sale sign on the lawn is a golden ticket.
Not even close. And I think it's important to validate something for you right off the bat. It is incredibly easy to get overwhelmed by the sheer volume of information out there.
Oh, absolutely.
Info overload is a massive barrier to entry in this space. People see the formulas, the percentages, the endless spreadsheet rows, and they just freeze.
It's intimidating.
It really is. But what our research clearly demonstrates today is that the math isn't there to intimidate you. It's actually a framework. It's a tool for critical thinking.
Oh, I thought.
Yeah, it is basically a shield designed to protect your capital from your own optimism.
A shield against optimism.
Man, I love that framing. Because before we can talk about building an empire or maximizing profits, we need to understand exactly how to measure those profits in the real world.
We have to move out of the abstract idea of wealth.
Right, and get into the concrete mechanisms that define whether a house is a complete dud or a home run. So let's jump right into the engine of wealth. Let's look at establishing a baseline, which means starting with the most fundamental calculation we have, the basic cash-on-cash return.
Right. So let's say you've found a place. And to keep the variables really clean for a second, let's imagine you are buying this property entirely in cash.
Okay, so no bank involved yet.
No bank at all. The research gives us a really great working model. You buy the house for $200,000. It needs a little work, maybe a new roof, some cosmetic updates. So you put in $20,000.
Right, so your total out-of-pocket investment is now $220,000.
Exactly. A straightforward all-cash transaction to establish our baseline. Now, let's look at what that money actually does for you.
The fun part.
Yeah. You rent it out, and it generates $24,000 in annual rental income. But of course, you don't just get to keep all of that.
If only.
Right. You have expenses, property taxes, insurance, routine maintenance. The methodology we're looking at pegs those operating expenses at, let's say, $6,000 for the year.
Okay, so 24,000 in rent minus 6,000 in expenses.
Which leaves you with $18,000 in your pocket at the end of the year.
And this is where we ask the critical question: is $18,000 a good return?
Well, to find out, we use the core ROI formula. You just asked, what percentage of my original investment is that profit?
So you take the $18,000 divided by the $220,000 you spent to get it.
And you arrive at an ROI of roughly 8.2%.
Which in the investing world is a very realistic, grounded number.
I always like to think of this baseline ROI calculation like checking the miles per gallon on a car before you buy it,
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah, like you don't buy a truck just because it looks tough. You want to know exactly how efficiently it burns fuel. ROI tells you exactly how hard your money is working. At an 8.2% return, your money is working pretty efficiently.
It really is. To give that some context, our sources point out that investors generally aim for an ROI that matches or exceeds the historical average return of the stock market.
Which is what? Usually around 7 to 10%?
Exactly. It hovers right around 7 to 10%. So for a rental property bought entirely in cash, landing in that 5 to 10% ROI window is considered a very solid, very reliable asset.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. What if you don't have $220,000 just like sitting in a duffel bag?
Which most people don't.
Right. The research introduces a second scenario that completely flips the script on how we view returns. We look at the exact same property.
The exact same rental income.
The exact same operating expenses. But instead of paying all cash, you use financing. Leverage.
Ah, leverage. I mean, it's the mechanism that drives almost all massive real estate wealth.
And it looks like absolute magic on paper.
Yeah.
In the simplified example from the source, you only put down a $50,000 down payment.
Okay.
You borrow the remaining $150,000 from a bank. And the text shows a scenario where if you divide that same $18,000 profit by your new tiny $50,000 investment,
your cash-on-cash ROI skyrockets to 36%.
36%.
Right, but we have to hit the brakes here for a second. What's fascinating about this simplified example is that it highlights the theory of leverage, but it completely ignores the reality of the mechanism.
Because that 36% return assumes the borrowed money is free.
Exactly.
And that was a huge sticking point for me when I was reviewing the numbers. You borrow $150,000. The bank obviously wants its cut. You have mortgage interest.
Precisely. Okay. Let's introduce the actual cost of money. In reality, you are making monthly mortgage payments.
Mm-hmm.
So your net profit isn't going to be $18,000 anymore.
Nope.
After paying the bank's interest, maybe your actual cash flow drops down to, let's say, $6,000 for the year.
Which, I mean, that sounds terrible at first. You went from making 18 grand to making 6 grand.
It sounds terrible until you actually do the math.
Yeah.
You take that smaller $6,000 profit, but you are dividing it by a much smaller initial investment.
Only the $50,000 you put down.
Right. $6,000 divided by $50,000 is a 12% return.
And there is the aha moment. Your total dollar amount and profit went way down, but the efficiency of your money, your actual percentage return, went from 8.2% up to 12%.
Exactly. That is why leverage works. It isn't magic. It is just the mathematical reality of using borrowed capital to multiply your cash-on-cash return.
It's brilliant.
You control a $200,000 asset, and you keep all the margin it produces above the cost of your loan, while only tying up a fraction of your own liquidity.
And the sources are really clear that an 8 to 12% range is a fantastic, realistic target for leveraged cash-on-cash ROI.
It's the sweet spot.
That makes perfect sense. But that beautiful 12% return relies entirely on the house operating perfectly, which brings us to a major reality check.
Yes, the defense side of the game.
Leverage dramatically magnifies your gains on the upside, but if your math is wrong, it brutally magnifies your losses on the downside. We have to look at what I call the silent ROI killers.
This is where we transition from the, you know, the clean theory of wealth to the messy reality of property management, the hidden variables that secretly drain your profitability.
Yeah, the sources list the vital operating expenses you absolutely must account for: property taxes, insurance, mortgage interest, and crucially, maintenance and vacancy.
Those last two are where people really get in trouble.
But I have to be honest, looking at the methodology and the research, I really struggled with some of their strict rules for budgeting these items.
Really? Where did you feel the methodology was off?
The pessimism. I mean, the text insists that you must budget 1% to 2% of the total property value annually just for maintenance.
Okay.
And then it says you have to estimate a 5% to 10% vacancy rate. A 10% vacancy rate means you are planning for this house to sit completely empty, generating $0 for over a month every single year. In a booming market where places are renting in 24 hours with massive bidding wars, aren't I just artificially tanking my ROI spreadsheet by planning for a ghost town? Why would I budget for a worst case scenario that simply isn't happening in the real world?
It feels like you're penalizing yourself. I completely get that. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, budgeting for that ghost town is exactly what separates a professional investor from an amateur.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah.
The golden rule presented across all this material is clear. be overcautious.
But doesn't that just kill deals? Like, if I factor in 2 months of an empty house and a destroyed roof every single year, my spreadsheet is going to tell me not to buy anything at all.
That is exactly the point. It should kill the mediocre deals.
Huh.
You mentioned a booming market, but markets are cyclical. What happens when a major employer leaves town? Or, you know, a pandemic hits?
Yes, that's fair.
Or what if new zoning laws flood the market with competing apartments? Suddenly, that 24-hour rental turnaround turns into a 60-day slog. If you built your entire ROI calculation on a best-case scenario...
Assuming the tenant will just stay forever.
Right. And assuming the water heater will never rust. If you do that, you haven't made an investment. You've made a gamble relying on absolutely perfect conditions.
Okay, I see. So you build the disaster into the baseline formula itself.
Precisely. The research insists that you plan for the worst so that you build a financial buffer. If things go well, you are pleasantly surprised, and you just have extra cash.
Which is never a bad thing.
Exactly. But if things go poorly, the property still pays for itself rather than driving you into bankruptcy.
That reframes it completely. It's essentially a stress test for the property. Speaking of stress, there's another trap the sources highlight that I think catches almost everyone, the DIY trap.
Ah, yes. The sweat equity illusion.
Right. The data shows that professional property management typically costs 8 to 12% of your monthly rent.
Which is a big chunk.
It is. And a lot of new investors look at that expense line and say, forget that. I'll just manage it myself. I'll keep the 10% and my ROI will look amazing.
A classic mistake.
But the text explicitly warns that ignoring the cost of management, even if you are the one doing it, completely skews your true ROI.
Because your time and labor are not worthless.
Exactly. I mean, if you are spending your Sunday mornings unclogging a tenant's toilet, painting baseboards, and constantly texting them to track down late rent, you haven't bought a passive investment.
No, you definitely haven't.
You have bought yourself a second job. If you don't factor in a dollar amount for that labor, your spreadsheet is just lying to you. Your actual return on investment is artificially inflated by your own free labor.
It's a very common blind spot.
Yeah.
The math has to reflect reality, and reality includes the cost of operations, regardless of whose hands are actually doing the work.
So true.
You always underwrite the deal assuming you were paying a professional, because eventually, you know, you will want to scale, or you'll just want your weekends back.
Okay, so we have our baseline math. We've explained how leverage juices the efficiency of our cash. And we've stress tested our spreadsheets against the silent killers like vacancy and DIY management.
We are playing excellent defense.
We are. But how do we go on the offense?
We shift our focus from calculating present-day cash flow to projecting long-term growth. We look at the total life cycle of the asset.
And the research introduces a brilliant distinction here. The difference between cash-on-cash ROI, which just looks at the money in your pocket today, and total ROI.
Right.
They walk us through a really detailed scenario of a $300,000 property to show how appreciation radically changes the math.
Let's break down the mechanics of that, because this is where generational wealth is actually built.
Okay, here is the scenario from the text. You buy a $300,000 property, you put down 20%, which is $60,000 cash.
Okay, got it.
You finance the rest. After you collect rent, pay the taxes, the insurance, the maintenance buffer, and crucially, pay the bank their mortgage payment, you are left with $5,000 in pure net cash flow for the year.
So using our earlier formula, $5,000 in profit divided by your $60,000 initial investment gives you an 8.3% cash-on-cash ROI.
Right. A solid, respectable return. The property is paying for its own existence and handing you $5,000. But here is the offensive play. The source says, let's look at the total ROI.
Because real estate isn't static.
Exactly. Let's assume the property itself appreciated in market value by a conservative 3% that year. 3% of $300,000 is $9,000.
That is $9,000 in new equity. It's wealth you've gained, even if you can't, you know, go to an ATM and withdraw it today.
Exactly. So now, to find your true net gain, you add your $5,000 in cash flow to your $9,000 in appreciation. Your total net gain for the year is actually $14,000.
Wow, okay.
Now divide that $14,000 by your original $60,000 cash investment.
And your total ROI leaps to an incredible 23.3%.
It's massive.
It is. This raises an important question, though. And the sources touch on this by introducing what might be the most misunderstood metric in real estate, ROE or return on equity.
Oh, this is a big one.
The formula is net income divided by your current owner's equity.
Wait, walk me through why a distinction matters. Why look at owner's equity instead of just my initial total investment?
Because your strategy has to adapt to the passing of time. Let's look at that exact same house, but fast forward 10 or 15 years.
Okay, I'm with you.
In year one, your total investment and your owner's equity are basically identical. That $60,000 down payment, earning a 23% return on that 60 grand, is fantastic.
Absolutely.
But over 15 years, two things have happened. First, your tenant has been paying down your mortgage balance every single month.
Right, the loan is getting smaller.
Exactly.
But
Second, the house has continued to appreciate. It's not worth $300,000 anymore. Maybe it's worth $450,000.
so I have a massive amount of wealth just trapped in the walls of the house.
Exactly. You might now have $250,000 in pure equity locked up in that property. But here's the trap. Your rent hasn't quintupled. Maybe your net cash flow is still only generating $7,000 or $8,000 a year.
Oh man, I see where this is going.
If you take that $8,000 in cash flow and divide it by your new massive $250,000 in equity.
Your return on equity has plummeted to around 3%.
Exactly. Your cash flow might feel safe, but that massive pile of equity sitting in the house is barely working for you at all. It's earning less than a standard high-yield savings account.
That is such a fascinating way to visualize it. The money gets lazy. It's like having an all-star player just sitting on the bench.
That's a perfect analogy. The lazy equity problem forces the professional investor to constantly evaluate their portfolio.
They can't just set it and forget it.
No, they have to ask, is this equity performing effectively, or do I need to pull it out, either by refinancing or selling, and leverage it as down payments on three new properties to get my percentage returns back up into the double digits?
So, what does this all mean for you, the listener, right now? Maybe you already own a property or you're about to buy one, but you aren't ready to go through the massive hassle of refinancing or buying a whole new house just to fix your lazy equity.
Right, you just want to optimize what you have.
You just want to make your current asset work harder. Well, the research provides some highly actionable strategies for juicing those ROI numbers immediately.
Yes, active improvement strategies that rely on optimization rather than acquisition.
The first one they highlight is surprisingly simple, but people avoid it all the time. Strategic regular rent increases.
It's so basic, but so overlooked.
The text suggests an annual review of the rent to ensure it matches current market rates. The psychology here is key. Many landlords are just afraid of losing a tenant, so they never raise the rent.
Which is a huge mistake over time.
But the sources point out that even a tiny incremental increase, just $50 a month, makes a disproportionately huge impact on your bottom line ROI.
Because it flows entirely to the bottom line.
Exactly. Your mortgage didn't go up, your insurance didn't go up. That extra $600 a year is pure margin that lands directly in your net profit.
And what about physical improvements?
They talk about renovations, but highly targeted ones. You don't just make it pretty based on your personal taste, you do value-adding upgrades.
Like what, specifically?
The data specifically highlights kitchens and bathrooms as the absolute best ROI boosters. They also strongly recommend energy-efficient upgrades.
That makes sense.
Yeah, why? Because it makes the property highly attractive to renters while simultaneously reducing the operating costs if you are the one covering utilities.
Which naturally leads to the importance of constantly auditing your expenses.
Right. Automating systems to reduce utility waste, shopping around annually for more competitive insurance rates, and negotiating those property management fees.
You have to treat it like a business.
You really do. And to tie this all together, the research mentions utilizing dynamic tech tools. For example, they highlight platforms like Osil Gamma.
Which acts as a sort of real-time operational dashboard.
Exactly. Think of it like a flight simulator for your real estate investments. Instead of guessing, you log into a platform like that, which functions as a dynamic ROI calculator.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, you can plug in the estimated cost of a $10,000 kitchen renovation, input the projected rent increase, and the software instantly shows you how that exact tweak affects your overall cash-on-cash and total ROI for the next 5 years. You immediately know if the math justifies the hammer.
It brings us right back to our core premise, really.
Well,
Making data-driven choices rather than emotional ones.
totally.
You don't upgrade the kitchen countertops because you think quartz looks elegant. You upgrade them because your real-time data modeling proves it will raise the rental value enough to accelerate your return on equity.
Okay, we have covered an immense amount of ground today. Let's synthesize this deep dive for you. If there is one major takeaway from combing through all this methodology, it's that calculating ROI is not just a math test you pass once to satisfy a mortgage broker.
Not at all.
It is the absolute foundational skill of investing.
It is the lens through which every single operational decision must be viewed.
Exactly. Understanding the mechanics of these formulas is how you evaluate deals impartially. It's how you spot the trap of a perfect property that secretly drains your cash, and how you find the ugly property that actually prints money.
It's empowering, honestly.
Ultimately, mastering ROI allows you to build a resilient, profitable portfolio without ever relying on gut feelings, neighborhood hype, or the emotional appeal of a nice oak tree in the backyard. It puts you firmly in control.
It absolutely does. But I want to leave you with a final thought to ponder today.
Oh, I like a final thought.
Yeah, something that builds on the deep admiration for spreadsheet logic we've discussed, but goes just a bit beyond it into the reality of being human.
Okay, let's hear it.
The methodology we reviewed champions leverage. It mathematically proves that using borrowed money maximizes your cash-on-cash ROI.
Unquestionably.
But consider this. As you faithfully pay down your mortgage over 15 or 30 years, your leverage decreases. As we discussed with the lazy equity problem, this technically drives your mathematical efficiency down relative to your massive wealth.
Right. The spreadsheet says you are doing it wrong by having a paid-off house.
Exactly. If you follow the pure cold logic of this investing framework to its absolute conclusion, the numbers will demand that you constantly refinance.
They will.
The math will tell you to repeatedly pull your money out, take on fresh debt, and buy more properties to keep your ROI percentage artificially high.
Yeah, that sounds exhausting.
Right. So at what point does the psychological ROI of owning a property completely debt-free, waking up knowing you owe the bank absolutely nothing, outweigh the mathematical perfection of keeping your assets highly leveraged?
That is a tough question.
It becomes the ultimate clash between cold spreadsheet efficiency and human peace of mind.
Oh, wow. That is a brilliant tension to highlight. Because at the end of the day, peace of mind is an emotion, isn't it?
It absolutely is.
We started this entire deep dive warning about the danger of letting emotion dictate your initial purchase. Getting swept away by the fresh paint instead of looking under the hood at the data.
Yeah.
But eventually, years down the road, once the data has done its job, once the engine has run perfectly and the wealth is built, well, the final reward you are actually trying to buy is that feeling of security.
Exactly. The math is just the vehicle to get you to that feeling safely.
Beautifully said. Well, that wraps up our analysis for today. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive.
It was a pleasure.
Before you take the plunge on your next investment, or even if you're just curious, we highly encourage you to sit down, pull up the data on a house in your own neighborhood, and crunch these baseline numbers for yourself. See what the engine is really doing. Until next time, keep digging into the data.